start to record it. Okay, so my name is Han Wen. I am with Troy Reeves at the Oral History Program at UW Campus. And today is May 6th, 2015. And I am with Professor Deborah Blum from School of Journalism today. Such an honor to have you today.
It's an honor to do this.
Talking to you. So just to start off, we're going to focus on your early childhood years. So to my understanding that you were born in Urbana, Illinois.
That's right. My dad was finishing up his PhD there, and my mother was a student in the journalism school there. So I was a student baby, right? And we only lived there, I'm probably getting ahead of it here, but we lived there till I was, I think I was about 6 months or so. We moved to Massachusetts. My dad was in the Army in a science unit up in Massachusetts. And then when I was two, we moved to Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and he had taken a job at LSU.
Okay. So after you spent some time in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, after you lived there for a little while, you moved to Bristol, England?
Right, my dad, I was about, not quite 12, I think. Is that, I'm trying to remember, 19, yeah, about right around there. And my dad did a sabbatical at the University of Bristol in Southeast England, and so we lived for a year in England, and I went to a Church of England school, which was pretty interesting, right? It was a interesting transition there and a rough transition back, because I came back a little British schoolgirl, and I really did not fit in Baton Rouge. When we were there one more year, and then my dad took a job at the University of Georgia, and we moved to Athens.
Okay. University of Georgia. And what was your mom doing at that time?
So when I was, my mother was a frustrated writer, I think. So when we were in Baton Rouge, she was a stay-at-home mom, but she did book reviewing for the Baton Rouge newspaper, The Morning Advocate. After we moved to Georgia, she went and got a master's degree in English. She was a student teacher, actually, in my high school, which was horribly embarrassing. And then she went to work also for the University of Georgia, and she was head of the publications program at the Institute of Government there.
Okay.
So they both retired from the University of Georgia.
Oh, okay. And if I'm correct on this, your father was an entomologist, is that correct?
He was an entomologist and chemical ecologist, so he specialized in the way insects communicate with each other.
Interesting.
It was interesting. He loved bugs almost more than his kids.
Yeah, I think you do have several siblings, right?
I'm the oldest of four girls.
Oh, okay.
And in this very 1950s way, we are all of our first names start with D and all of our middle names start with L, which is a terrible thing. So it's Deborah Lee, Darcel Lynn, Dawn Lizette, and Dana Leslie.
Wow.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Okay. Well, why was it like this? Why was it start with D?
I'm the oldest. I mean, I think my parents just kind of got into the idea of having us all have the same initials. That's all I can figure out, because it just really otherwise doesn't make any sense. They just liked it.
Okay.
And they never said why they did it, but I think they thought it was kind of fun. When I was younger, we were all had exactly the same initials, DLB. And I'm the only one who still has those initials, because all of us got married, but I kept my maiden name and no one else did.
Mm-hmm.
So So now at least people can tell us apart that way.
Right? Which is a good thing.
Which is a good thing. My mother still mixes up our names, right? I mean, there's too many D's in the family, so she'll call us by each other's names.
Okay. Yeah. Wow, sounds like a very interesting family. You have a really good childhood, sounds like.
A close childhood. You know, my father, and I know this, my father loved the natural world. He always brought it home. I think I've written about this on occasion. You know, we'd have tarantula. He gave me a tarantula as a pet. We had a black widow spider for a while as a center. I mean, in a box, in the dining room table, right? He took us on collecting trips, right? We had pet snakes. We had a pet ocelot, right? One of his friends had been trapping ocelots in Central America, and he brought home the cubs, right? That didn't work out very well. But so it was very, you know, love for nature, fascination with science kind of childhood, right? Okay. I've always thought it was a big influence on how I grew up.
Yeah, okay. Great. So I think now we're going to move on to your undergraduate studies. Mm-hmm. So, are you into University of Georgia, just like your parents? And you received a bachelor degree in journalism in 1976?
That's right.
Okay. So could you talk about how did you decide to go to University of Georgia and how you decided to study journalism?
Sure. Well, originally I didn't want to be a journalist. I was going to be a chemist. And I had fallen in love with, it makes me sound like a complete geek, but I had fallen in love with chemistry in high school. I really loved it. And so my freshman year, I actually went to Florida State University. I was an honors science majors chemistry person. And that was where I discovered that although I loved chemistry, I was like a complete disaster in a laboratory. I set my hair on fire. They had to evacuate the lab one day when I generated a toxic lab. I shouldn't laugh. It was horrible. And I just didn't know what to do with myself, right? I was just, what am I going to be if I'm not going to be a chemist? My father was super disappointed in me. But I thought, well, yeah, you know, I kind of like to write. I want to get paid. I've always been very practical. So I'll go to journalism school. And the University of Georgia had a real, and still has a really good journalism school. So I transferred back to Georgia and went to work for the student newspaper there and fell in love with journalism. To my surprise, right? It was kind not a calling. It was a, okay, this is the best I can do. I'm going to major in journalism.
Okay. And the newspaper that you wrote articles for was called The Red and Black, mm-hmm. Is that right?
That's the University of Georgia student newspaper. And I worked for that paper for 3 years. I started out as a baby reporter, not having a clue, and then I was editor by the time I finished.
Okay. And so that was a pretty pretty crucial experience for you to transition to the next to a future career.
The Red and Black was great, and some of it was that when you're a student journalist at a, you can write about anything that interests you. We could write about anything that interested us, and so I spent a lot of time. I wrote about poverty. I did a series on poverty in Athens. I've always been interested in that kind of social justice end of things, and it's covered problems at the university and worked all the time. And I was in a community of people that lived at that paper, and we're still friends. That to me is one of the amazing things, is we were so close, we worked so hard, and we cared so much about what we did. I mean, we were really a little passionate little group of journalists in that right after Watergate, you know, when everyone was going to do really cool stuff in journalism. So, man, we've been friends. That's got to be more than 40 years. I was just back at Georgia. I hung out with some of my old Red and Black friends. I got invited to give a talk at the Red and Black by one of my friends who is now on the board. When I went book touring in Georgia, all my Red and Black friends came, right, to hang out. And so it taught me an infinite amount about journalism, but it also you know, was a wonderful community and one I'm happy to keep. I like to keep people.
Right.
Yeah.
People is always nice to keep.
Yes, that's right.
So your close friends, they are working as in the journalism field in Georgia currently.
Some of them are, you know, scattered around the country. There's, and some of them are still in journalism and some of them aren't, right? Some of them are in public relations. And probably one of the people I'm closest to is a novelist now. She writes women's chick lit, right? A very successful chick lit, right? I'm always jealous, you know, I'm running around, you know, trying to put these complicated, heavily researched things together, and she's sitting in her backyard making them shut up. So unfair.
So it's so different from what you do as well.
That's right.
Yeah.
But it's really fun to, you know, read her stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you graduated from University of Georgia,
mm-hmm.
and so did you work, right afterwards, did you work as a reporter,
mm-hmm.
You work as a reporter in a couple of different places?
That's right. So while I was an undergrad at Georgia, I did three internships. I interned for a very small weekly paper, and then I interned for a small daily, and then I interned for a U.S. Senator, Sam Nunn, who was on the Armed Services Committee. Just to do it. I didn't want to be a political reporter. And then one of the newspapers that I interned for hired me right out of school. And that was in Gainesville, Georgia, which is a little paper up in the Appalachia. And I was a police and fire reporter there for a year. And then I went to another paper in Georgia. And then I went to the St. Pete Times in Florida. And at all of those papers, I did police and cops and City Hall and education, I mean, general assignment reporting. Until I said to myself, okay, I love journalism, but I want to write about something I care about, and that's going to be science. And I quit my job at the St. Pete Times, which was pretty scary to go to grad school.
So you quit you quit your job at St. Petersburg's Times?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So what was your next career choice for you? Your career
track? It's a little bit unplanned again. So I decided I wanted to go to graduate school, and at the same time, I was dating a copy editor at the St. Pete Times, Peter Haugen, who's the guy I'm married to, and he's a native Californian. He decided to move back to California, and he got a job at the Fresno Bee, which is kind of close to where his family is. So I thought, well, I'll move out to California with my boyfriend. This is like not, you know, the perfect career plan. And I'll go to Berkeley. And so I applied to Berkeley. I was going to go through their grad program and specialize in science writing. And when I was getting my recommendations, one of the people that I asked to recommend me was the dean of the University of Georgia Journalism School, who was a guy named Scott Cutlip, who was had been a very successful public relations professor here at the University of Wisconsin before he went to Georgia. And he gave a lot of money to the State Historical Society here. He wrote a famous textbook and all this other stuff. So when I asked him for the recommendation to Berkeley, he said, sure, I'll do that, but you ought to go to Wisconsin. And I thought the way you do when you're in your 20s, right? I went, oh, maybe I should apply to two schools. I'd only applied to Berkeley. And so I applied to Wisconsin as my backup plan to be a science writer. And I got into Berkeley, but Scott had connected me to the guy who was my advisor at Wisconsin. It's all people, right?
Right.
He had connected me to the guy who was my advisor at Wisconsin, who's absolutely fabulous, wildlife reporter named Clay Schoenfeld. And Clay put me up for a UW fellowship, and I got it. And he also put me up for an Outdoor Writers of Association scholarship, and I got that. So I looked at it, and I was going to put myself through grad school anyway, and I thought, I should go to the, I mean, literally, I thought, I'll just go to the place where you know, I'm not going to go broke going to grad school. And that was a lot of why, that was part of why I came to Wisconsin. I got really good funding, and which a lot, everyone does, right? And they had a more specialized science writing program in Berkeley. So I had gone out to California. I had had a temporary job at the Fresno Bee while I was waiting to get into grad school. I quit my temporary job and took a train out here and came to Wisconsin and did the specialized reporting program in the School of Journalism and Mass Communication.
So you chose to come to UW-Madison.
I did.
But your husband and Peter,
He stayed in California.
Right, he was your boyfriend at the time. He stayed.
He worked for the Fresno paper. We weren't engaged, right? And so we decided we'd just see if it would work or not, right? Long distance relationships are hard. Yeah, as you know, almost all of us have to go through that, and they're no fun. And the other person gets, like, not as real to you after a while, right? So you really have to work at it. But when I went back for spring break, he asked me to marry him. So I came back engaged.
Wow.
Yeah.
Exciting.
It was very exciting. I finished up my degree. And then we got married the next year. I mean, that fall of 1982. And I had to take my oral exam. So... Meanwhile, the Fresno Bee had hired me back as a science writer. They took a big gamble, right? They'd never had a science writer, but they liked me when I did the temporary job. So they hired me back as their first science writer, and they gave us a week vacation for us to get married and for me to take my oral exams. So we went to Georgia and got married, and then we went to Wisconsin so I could take my oral exams, and that was it. For the honeymoon, right?
Wow.
I know my advisor said I was the only brand new bride he'd ever seen who had a suitcase full of books. And so I passed my orals, I got my master's, and I went back to Fresno.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I'd like to talk about more into your graduate school career, your time at graduate school, if that's okay.
Yeah, sure.
So at UW-Madison, you majored in environmental journalism.
Mm-hmm.
Could you talk about some of the classes that you took that you find really enjoyable?
Yeah, and I have to say, and this is not promotional, that grad degree is one of the smartest things I ever did. It influenced me as a journalist in so many important ways. And when I did it, what I was thinking is, well, I want to be a science writer at the New York Times. I was pretty, and I'm going to have some credentials to do that, so I'm going to get a grad degree. That was my plan. Of course, I didn't start working to the New York Times until now, but and the other thing for me was that I'd always been an environmentalist, and so, I mean, I always cared. I mean, that's my upbringing, right? Nature matters. The world around us matters. How do we better take care of it? So when I came here, I wanted to be an environment writer, and my advisor, in fact, was wildlife, had a joint appointment in journalism and in wildlife biology, so he was perfect. And so I took natural resources management, that was a great class. I took environmental toxicology, that was a great class. And then the other classes that I took, you know, the journalism school classes, which were mostly specialized reporting. Remember all of my classes, History of Journalism, which I loved, and I wrote about Darwin and the Scopes Trial in my History of Journalism class. But the other thing is that Clay, my advisor, said to me, he goes, there are no good science writers who don't know the history of their field, so you should be taking history of science classes. The University of Wisconsin has one of the best history of science departments in the world. And you should take those classes. So that's the other thing I did, is I took History of Science and Technology, and I took Darwin and the History of Biology, and all of those classes made me think a lot about how what you report on today sits in the timeline of its history, right? And also, if you take enough history of science, you realize how much really smart stuff we've forgotten, and how easy it is. And this was the other point that he would make. He'd say, you know, you're going to hear a lot of people saying, I'm the original discoverer, I'm the first to come up with this idea. And he said, and if you know the history, you're going to find out a lot of times that's not true. So I took a lot of history of science, and I didn't realize it at the time, but that hugely shaped the way I was going to think about science reporting forever, right? So I went back. Fresno hired me right out of school, and they hired me as an environment writer.
Okay. And how long did you work for the Fresno Bee?
I was there 2 years after I graduated.
So coming back to your undergraduate careers at Madison, were you involved in any student organizations at that time?
No, not really. I had a really good community of graduate students. I'm still friends. There was another woman, Madonna King, and Clay. She had also gotten an outdoor writer scholarship. And when I got Clay was going to hire me as his grad assistant, but when I got the UW fellowship, he gave it to Donna. And Donna and I are still friends. She went on and she became a natural resources public information officer for the state of Washington. And I just saw her last year, right, which is pretty cool. But no, I worked like a dog on that graduate degree. I used to tell people that I had never worked as hard when I got paid for it as I did when I was in graduate school. The classes were smart and they were hard, and I'm a very competitive person, so once I got started, I wanted to be really good. And the other thing I did is that I still continue to do some newspaper writing. And you don't have to do that now so much, but when I was there, and you were in the specialized reporting program, you had to actually write and get published in some of the in your field, and then you had to defend your publications as part of your orals. So my oral committee was two people from the School of Journalism and one from the History of Science department, and I had I'd been taking this course in Darwin and the History of Biology, and I had discovered in my class that it was the 150th anniversary of Darwin's death. So I wrote two big kind of think opinion page pieces on the anti-evolution movement. Boy, that hasn't gone away. Anchoring it to this Darwinian anniversary. And I published that at two newspapers I had worked for. Did a California version for the Fresno paper and a Florida version for the St. Pete Times, right? And then pitched some environment stories to magazines. So except for playing with my friends working for newspapers and trying to get through school, I didn't join any committees, right? Okay. Completely focused time here.
Okay. So you are taking all these classes and you are still writing papers for
right.
those, writing articles for those two newspapers.
For the two newspapers, right.
Okay.
I mean, I still had, Donna was a super outdoorsy person and I had brought my cross-country skis with me. So I spent a lot of time cross-country skiing. We skied out on Lake Mendota when it froze, and we went over to Kettle Moraine and skied some of the trails there. It was super cold that year, too. I mean, just, it was so cold when I was in graduate school. Even after I moved back to Madison until like the other year when we had that super cold winter, I was like, oh, okay, everyone here is a wuss because I froze to death when I was in graduate school, but it was horrible. So, and I grew up in the South, right? Louisiana, Georgia, Florida, California, that was the hardest thing for me when I moved here was the winter, right? And I still, with the first snowfall every year, I'm like, oh, not again.
Oh, wow. Well, even after so many years, you still have to get used to the...
That's exactly right.
Whenever winter comes.
Yeah.
Wow. Very interesting. So you graduated from University of Wisconsin.
Yes, I had a 4.0 average. I mean, I worked like a dog. I was like Miss Perfect. So, yeah.
Okay. And then you worked 2 years at the Fresno Bee. It's Fresno Bee, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, did you work at other newspapers after Fresno Bee?
So I spent 2 years at the Fresno Bee, and then and my husband worked there as a copy editor, and then we both were moved up to the Sacramento Bee. Both of those papers are part of a newspaper chain, McClatchy Newspapers, and Sacramento was their big flagship newspaper. And so they decided up in Sacramento to start, they had never had a science desk either, right? They decided they would, they had an environment reporter. And I didn't want to be an environment reporter anymore. That was the other thing for me. Because after 2 years in Fresno, even though, I mean, I did some work there that I still really love, but being an environment reporter is so political, right? You're always, everything that we do with the environment is embedded in public policy decisions. And so half the time I was never talking to scientists, I was talking to regulators and administrators and county supervisors and state agencies. And I thought, well, that wasn't what I wanted. I wanted to write about science. I wanted to explain how things worked. I wanted to know how things worked, right?
Mm-hmm.
So when the SAC Beast decided to do this, they said, well, we already have an environment writer. I said, I want to be an environment writer. I'm just a complete geek. It was why I liked chemistry so much. I wanted to be a science writer. So they brought me up to be their first science writer. And they kept their environment writer, who was a really good guy named Tom Harris, and they added a medical writer. And so I was part of that first set of science, medicine, environment that the Bee had ever had. And when I got there, they had no idea what to do with me. They're just like, okay,
mm-hmm.
right. Why are you here? Really, because it was the editor-in-chief had come from the Chicago, one of the big Chicago papers, and they'd always had science writers. But the Sacramento Bee was a political paper. It was in California's capital. So they're like, why do we have a science writer? Is there any science in Sacramento? Why did we hire her? It was a really interesting transition.
Okay, cool. How long did you work for Sacramento Bee?
13 years.
13 years,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So other than Sacramento Bee's, you also have some other writing experience in some other different places, such as the Speakeasy Science,
mm-hmm.
as one of the blogs that you're dedicated to.
I've done three different blogs, really. So what happened when I came to... So I have to explain that. I have to get ahead of myself. The Sacramento Bee was the last place where I was a staff writer, right? And when I came to Wisconsin, they hired me sort of to be a writer in residence, right? I have an MA. I don't have a PhD. And they had one position. They were one of my Wisconsin professors who focused on science writing, Sharon Dunwoody, recruited me. They had this one job, which was for a working writer in residence, and I'm the third person in that position. And when the other guy who'd been a New York Times international correspondent decided to retire, she said, you should come back. But when they did the letter of agreement, they said, we want you to continue to be a working writer who teaches. So at that point, I became a freelancer as well as an instructor. And I wrote for all kinds of different publications. And it was important to me, too. I mean, I think of myself as a journalist as more than I probably think of myself as an academic. I don't do academic research, right? I'm a writer.
Right.
And being a writer is breathing to me. There was no, I didn't want the job if I couldn't be a writer. And I knew, so I wrote for, all kinds. I wrote for Rolling Stone. I wrote for women's magazines. I wrote for Scientific American, I wrote for Time Magazine. Over the time I've been here, I did a lot of magazine freelancing. And then about six-ish years ago, I got interested in blogging. And I was kind of going back to my roots as a chemistry writer. So I started my own blog. It was after Poisoner's Handbook came out, so I was very interested in the 1920s. So I called the blog Speakeasy Science. And I did that on my own website at first, and then it got picked up over at the Public Library of Science. It got picked up at Science Blogs. And then Science Blogs, this is so ridiculous, imploded in this big explosion of bad advertising policy. And so I quit. I took my blog over to Speakeasy Science, over to the Public Library of Science blogs. And then after I was there about a little over a year, Wired asked me if I would blog for them. And they renamed the blog Elemental, and I blogged at Wired for 2 years. And then while I was blogging at Wired, the New York Times asked me if I would blog for them, and they called the blog Poison Pen. And that's the blog, and that blog is on hold while I finish my book. So I've just blogged across all these. I love blogging, it's really fun. Right. I miss my Wired blog because I could do whatever I wanted, and with the Times it's super edited and I can't do whatever I want. But that's my blogging career.
Okay.
Right.
Wow, very fascinating.
Yeah.
Which year did you start writing for the Wired?
Okay, let me think.
Recall.
Yeah, about 2010, and I know maybe 11. And I blogged for them until about 2014. I blogged for the Wired for about 3 years, I guess. From about 2011 to, I closed the blog up in 2014. So sometime in that time period. Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if I hit that number,
I think now I want to move on to another very important time of your life. That was in 1992. That was when you received the Pulitzer Prize
for the Sacramento Bee. That's right.
Right. When you were writing about the primate research,
mm-hmm.
Could you talk about its impact on your career, just in general?
Yeah. So when you win a Pulitzer Prize, if you're a newspaper writer, there's this moment where you can change your career, and actually there's. People have talked about this. You have this window where everyone's very interested in you. And then if you just keep doing what you're doing, that when that door closes and you're just still a staff writer who won a Pulitzer a few years ago. And I knew that because at the Bee, there were reporters who had won Pulitzers, and they were still doing exactly what I was doing. And there were reporters who had won Pulitzers, and they had written books, and that had really changed their lives. So when I won the Pulitzer, which was, like, insane, that was an insane time, right? It's just crazy, the week you win it is insane. And all these book agents from New York contacted me and said, we think your series would make a great book, and you should turn it into a book, and I can make you a lot of money. That was the common theme. Sign with me, I'll make you a lot of money. And I did sign with an agent. I did want to do a book. I did want to change my life, right? And so the agent I signed with didn't promise that she would make me any money. But she asked really smart, tough questions. And I wanted to work with someone who would ask really smart, tough questions. And so she's still my agent. She's much more successful than me. Right. She is now the co-director of the literary division at William Morris. But I've been her client since 1992. So we're still together, and she's sold every book I've ever done. And so I walked through that door, right? Mm-hmm. And it was, sometimes I thought, you know, be careful what you wish for, because it's been really hard to balance my life ever since, right? But I wanted to take that opportunity, and I wanted to write books. I've always wanted to try all different kinds of writing. That's one reason I love blogging, is because you can experiment, right? And I wanted to see if I could write books, you know. I think almost everyone who is a serious journalist thinks about it, and so I wanted to try it.
Okay.
And once you've written a book, that changes your life too, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so it's like this ripple effect. But that started with the Pulitzer, yeah. So the Pulitzer changed a lot of things for me.
Okay. Do you mind to go into details, talk about how some of the challenges that you encounter to balance your life after you receive the prize.
Well, so I'm a working mom. The year I won the Pulitzer, I have a son who was born in 1989 and a son who was born in 1994. So the year I won the Pulitzer, Marcus, my older guy, was, you know, 3. And, man, I was just on the road. You know, everyone wanted me to talk. Everyone wanted me to... I was trying to sell my book. I had to go to New York and meet with publishers. It launched me on this period that I think I've never really quit of having 1 foot in the house and 1 foot out the door, right? It was really, there was one time I was going to give a talk, and he was just this little bitty guy, and he and my husband came to the airport to see me off, and he followed me down the jetway crying. I was crying when I got on the plane, right? I still think sometimes I should have gotten off the plane, right? So from that point on, you know, I was always trying to balance an increasingly demanding career.
Yeah.
With the fact that my kids really matter to me. And sometimes I think I did it well, and sometimes I think I didn't. You know, I can look back and I'm really close to both my sons. I just found this little memoir thing that one of my younger son did in the 4th grade, in which at one point in it, I was looking at it and he goes, "My mom is the most patient person in my family." And I thought, wow, because I'm like the most impatient person I know, right? But I was always trying to figure out ways to be a good mom, right? And, you know, people will say to me, well, women are harder on themselves about this. But every time that I left, that I wasn't there, that I missed something, I'd be like, am I letting my kids down because my career is so important to me? And so I ask myself that a lot, right? And it's a huge relief to me at this stage when my older son's 25. And my younger guys just turned 21 today. I'm going to pick them up at the university after this and take them over for dinner. But that we're still close, and that if I say to them, and that they know they're top of my list, right? But doing that, making your kids believe that they are top of your list when you're gone all the time. And, you know, the last few years I've been on an airplane often every other week, right, is really hard.
Right.
And really stressful. And and my husband will say to me while I'm doing it, and one of the persons who gets sacrificed in my balancing out was probably my husband, right? Which he has pointed out to me, right? I mean, we've had fights about who's top on your list. He goes, "Am I in the top 10 on your list?" And I go, "Well, not today." Because you're really annoying. But, you know, it's hard. And so, you know, you look at it and you go, okay, I feel like I pulled this off relatively well, but it was hard and it was not perfect. And I worried and stressed and missed important dates. And, you know, I think all parents do that. If I, you know, I've asked myself, I hope that women in this not my generation, but the next generation, my kids' generation, I hope they're smarter about it, right? I have a better sense of balance, right? My generation, you know, I think the other thing for me, and then I'm done talking, I hope, about this, just because I'm going on and on, but when I graduated from the University of Georgia, I got offered the reporting job I took and a copy editing job at a much larger paper. And I was like, should I go to the bigger paper, right? And I wouldn't have been a reporter, but I thought maybe I could transition over. Or should I take the reporting job? And the career advisor at the University of Georgia was an old retired Army guy. So I went to talk to him about it. He goes, take the copy editing job, because everyone knows that women, you know, get pregnant, have kids after a couple of years, and the reporting job is wasted on them. You should let men take those jobs. And I was so angry. I'm still angry. My friends and I from the Red and Black still talk about this guy, because I wasn't the only woman that he said, you know, I don't even know why you're in journalism. It's a man's career. And I took the reporting job that day. I stormed off, picked up the phone, and took the reporting job that day. But I think, you know, I graduated in 76. We were still, journalism still a male-dominated profession. And my generation in particular, in that 70s, 80s, it was like, stand up for yourself, this super... You know, we were sort of at not in the beginning of the feminism movement, but at a point where you really felt like you were building stuff because other women hadn't been able to do it. So, you know, it was really hard for me to say no when I felt like I was trying, you know, I would feel it for myself and I'd be like, and I want to, you know, break down a few walls here, right? So I put a lot of pressure on myself, right? So not the have it all thing, but... Be a science writer who makes a difference. Be a woman science writer who makes a difference. But also be a perfect mom and a great wife and a wonderful sister and a wonderful friend. And you just, you know, you just like can wear yourself to pieces that way. It's hard.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I actually didn't think about, wow, back in the days there was this misconception that like women should, you know, do this and that. They shouldn't go into reporting.
Yeah, and that's not that long ago. And when I first went to work at the Fresno Bee, I was doing some cop report. This was the temporary part. And there was a murder at a gas station. And the city editor, who was a nice old guy named Jim Forbes, he goes, well, if you were a man, I would send you to the crime scene, but you're a woman, and I can't send you because it wouldn't be safe. So I told him to fire me. I've always said to people, it was so ridiculous. It was a temporary job, so it wasn't like a huge deal. But, I mean, it wasn't like putting my career or my income on the line if he had fired me. I said to him, if you don't think I can do this job, then you have to fire me. I wish you could have seen his face. He just went, you know, jaw drops, and he sent me there. And, I mean, what else could he do, right? And the thing is, if you're a police reporter, you know that right after a murder, it's the safest place in town because there's like 100 cops, right? So I was surrounded by police. It was not a big deal. But you still, you know, but I, especially when I was starting out, you were always pushing it on that. So, you know, you can get yourself in this mode where you say, I'm building something here, and this really matters, right? And every single woman of my generation, I think, you know, people all talk about us being the have-it-all generation. I don't know that it was that, but I do think women in my generation felt like they had to push, right? Uh-huh. And that probably played into it, too, right?
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah.
So... You had so much going on in your career, like you were able to balance everything. Wow.
It never felt like it. I can tell you that now, when I talk to my son in Chicago, you know, once or twice a week still, and that when I talk to my son here, you know, more than that, and that when we're friends, and the, when they want to do stuff, I think... I pulled this rabbit out of the hat, and I wouldn't, you know, I wasn't sure, right? So I feel really lucky, and I feel lucky that they're great kids. They were great kids, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they were very appreciative of the time that you spent with them, and as well as your caring for them and all other responsibilities for the family.
And my husband thinks they valued me more because I was so hard to get. That could be true too.
Uh-huh. Right. So your youngest son goes to school at UW-Madison?
He starts in the fall. He's been in the liberal arts transfer from MHUC. And so he lives down on, you know, in one of the student housings off university campus, and then he just got admitted to UW.
Okay.
I'm very excited about
that's
it.
That's very good news.
Yeah, he's a great kid.
And then your older son is in Chicago. Is he going to school or is he working?
He graduated from UW. Yeah. He had an anthropology degree and an archaeology certificate, and then he decided he wanted to be an improv artist. That was a head-spinning moment for his mother. right? Where you're just like, didn't I just put you through an expensive program? But I didn't say that. But he went down to Chicago. Actually, one of my best friends lives in Chicago, and she helped him get a job. I mean, you know, an anthropology degree does not get you a whole lot of jobs, right? So he got a job working in the jewelry business because that's where she had connections. And now he works for an internet coupon company. And he is studying, he wants to get an MBA. And so he's studying to take the GMAT this month. And then he wants to go to grad school in Chicago. So. And it suits him perfectly. He's like was one of those kids who's like, oh, calculus is easy. He has a real analytical mind. He was weasy, he would have been a great scientist, right?
Yeah.
Right? But that's just not the route he chose to go. And what I always said to my kids was, I'm going to be proud of, pick something you love and do it well, and I'll be proud of you, right? It doesn't have to be a status thing. And my childhood was very different from that. My mom, again, with the same thing. My mom was a very frustrated woman with a lot of drive and ambition and talent who was a stay-at-home mom. And, I mean, she made it very clear that we better not fool around and we better go out and do something. And that it better be something good. And when I graduated from college, University of Georgia, she took me for a walk and she said, I don't want you to get married. I want you to only have affairs. I don't want to, don't come home and tell me that you've screwed up your career for marriage. And I'm like, okay. I always say to people, whose mother says that? But she, you know, it was like, you're going to make a difference, right? And so I didn't want to, even though I think that made me more driven, and I am driven, which can be good, I wasn't going to do that to my kids, right? I mean, and the ways that you want to be different from your parents, I was not going to say to my kids, you know, go out and do something that's super important or don't come home, right? So, yeah, I'd forgotten how much that, another major influence in my life, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So you have talked about all your writing experience at the different newspapers, your blogs, and some the books that you've written, a couple of books, as well as the several other newspaper journals. And so I wonder if you could talk about your overall writing process and your approach to writing in general.
Well, I'm, you know, a science writer, and that's evolved some with time. I started out much more investigative. I'd grown up inside science because of my dad. And so I spent a lot of time, especially when I was a newspaper science writer, trying to write about science as I saw it, which was as a human enterprise, right? So I wanted to tell stories in which I could connect people with science by showing that, you know, it was just other people trying to understand the world, because we're very, culturally in the U.S., there's an anti-intellectual kind of vibe that's built into our culture that often plays out into an anti-science kind of attitude. And so it was really important to me to tell stories that illuminated it as a human process and one that was part of people's lives. So I like to write about everyday science. That's been true in my books and in my magazine and blogging stuff. Science is part of your life. It's not scary. It doesn't exist on some super intellectual plane where it's only accessible to people who are smarter than you. I don't believe that, right? And so when I've written about it, I've always tried to write about it from a, you know, this is a human enterprise. Since I started doing books, I still think that, but I've changed my approach some in that, you know, I've used narrative history of science as a way of getting at it. There's where my grad degree came back in, because I was always so fascinated by history and history of science, and I trained in it here at Wisconsin. And I started, the first book I did like that was Love at Goon Park. So I wrote two books, so I'm working on my sixth book. Yeah. Six books, and then I edited two editions of Field Guide. I've done way too much in my, you know, prove yourself moment. But in 2002, I wrote Love at Goon Park, which is about Harry Harlow here at the University of Wisconsin. And that's a narrative history of science. And then all the book I'm working on now is that Ghost Hunters was that, and Poisoner's Handbook is a narrative history of science. And with all of those books, my idea of how I want to tell a story of science has evolved into something that I think of as a little more, what's the word? It's more, it's less direct. It's, I'm going to tell you a wonderful story. What I hope is going to be a wonderful story. I'm going to tell you a great story. And there's going to be science woven through that story. And if I'm smart enough, you're just going to enjoy the story, and you're not going to realize how much science I'm sneaking into this. So if you looked at Poisoner's Handbook, it's the story of these two crusading crime fighters in New York City in this fabulous jazz age era, right, who are trying to catch murderers. But woven through it is a whole hell of a lot of chemistry, right? And so I'm going to come in the back door and do the science writing by weaving it through what I hope is a really good story. And so that I'm, and so I've gotten much more, much sneakier, right, in the way I write about science. Right? I want it to be a good story first, and the science flows with that.
Yeah.
Because, sorry. The audience I want is not the science literate audience, right? And I think about audience a lot, and I don't want to preach to the choir. Even when I wrote a piece on semiochemistry, which is communication between living species, for Scientific American, I don't have to sell that audience on the idea that chemistry is cool, right? They already get it. So that's not really an I've only wrote for Scientific American once, because that's not an audience that interests me. It's the audience outside the box that interests me, the people who are like, science is boring, science is scary, I don't like science, I don't understand science. I want those guys. And so the other thing is that if you took something like Poisoner's Handbook, it was a finalist for a murder mystery award, and I went to a convention of murder mystery writers. That's the audience I want, the people who aren't normally interested in science. And so that really shapes the way I try to tell science stories.
Right.
Yeah.
And your prisoner's handbook were also adapted by the PBS.
Yeah, it was a documentary on American experience.
So that was just made your book more accessible to a larger audience.
That's exactly right. They did a wonderful job, and it sold a lot of books for me. But yeah, it was another way to reach out and say, here's an audience beyond the science literate audience. Because the science literate audience, not that I don't want my stuff to be smart, and I want it to be right, but those guys don't need this, right? If we're going to change the conversation about science, if we're going to, and we're not doing a very good job of it despite my brilliant reporting on chemistry and everything else, but if we're going to change the conversation so that we can get people to look at things like climate change or vaccination or fluoridation of water with some kind of common sense understanding of science, that's the audience we have to reach, right? And it's so frustrating to see us go backwards, right? And it's so frustrating to be able to look at something like climate change, where it's so easy to connect the dots and think, why aren't we recognizing this? Why don't we, right? And so when you see that NOAA announced today that the average levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are now above 400 parts per million, we haven't been there for more than 4 million years. Back in a period in time when pine forests covered the Arctic, right, because it was so warm there. Why can't people get that? I mean, and so it's not that science journalists are solely responsible for this problem, but for someone like me who really cares about that audience, it's like, how do I reach you? Do I have to knock you over the head? Right, maybe, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, it's really frustrating.
Okay. And I wonder, the audience for your books, do they get feedback from you regarding whether, I love how you approach writing, it's so easy for me to read, even though I don't have a science background.
I get a lot of that. I mean, especially with Poisoner's Handbook, right? Because Poisoner's Handbook kind of cut across. With Ghost Hunters was weird, fringy science, so that was a different thing, but But Poisoner's Handbook's been the most publicly accessible kind of book that I did in that way. So it got taught in a lot of high school chemistry classes, and it got taught in high school English classes. And I've actually done Skype conversations with high school classes all over the country, and actually been flown out of the Rutgers Preparatory Academy, picked it as Book of the Year for the whole school, and flew me out to do a series of talks, right? One of my favorites was this mom wrote me. I mean, I'm so easy to find on the internet. So people write me all the time, or I still see it on Twitter, loved this book, right, which is so fun for me. But this one mom wrote me, she had read the book to her 8-year-old son, and he had loved the book so much that when they had their elementary school Halloween costume party, he went to the party as Alexander Gettler, who's one of the scientists in my book, and she sent me the photo. It was really cool, right? I loved it. What I don't love is all the people who write me. They think their brother's trying to murder them. They think they're, and they'll write me and they'll go, "Help me solve this horrible crime." And I'm just like, one guy wrote me, he goes, "My sister-in-law, I know my sister-in-law poisoned my brother, and then she had the body cremated. And I rushed over to the crematorium before they burned him to ash. I ripped a bunch of hair out of his head because I know you can find toxic things in hair. And what do you think I should test for?" And I'm just going, I was just like, I wrote him back. I've quit writing those kind of people back, right? Uh-huh. Because you just get too much into the crazy zone. And I do understand that, you know, they're unhappy and desperate and scared and angry and feel like no one listens to them. So I, you know, but when I have started conversations with those kind of people, they never end. So I just have to go, "No, right, I'm not going to do these dialogues." Most of the time I write them back. I'm not a toxicologist. I am a journalist. If you want to, you should talk to someone who actually, you know, is a scientist. And so that's the other thing, is a lot of these guys, I mean, they're not afraid to find a scientist, they're afraid to talk to a scientist, I seem more accessible, it's really sad. But yeah, I know this book is connected with all kinds of people like that, and that's really fun. And I also hear from murder mystery writers who are trying to find the perfect poison. And I even read, there's a really nice chapter here of the Romance Writers of America. Uh-huh. And I gave a talk to them because a lot of romances are romantic suspense. So I told them how to poison characters in their books, right?
Yes. That was fun.
It was funny.
Yeah.
Silly, but funny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I can see that why some users approach you as, like, they see you as an authority, and they don't know any scientists in the field to talk to.
That's so, exactly right, and so I'm more approachable.
Right.
After I did, the second book I did after the monkey book was Sex on the Brain, and the other thing that would happen, I thought this was so funny, but I did a lot of promotional stuff for that book. My publisher super promoted it, right? I went on the Today Show, I went on Good Morning America, I did all of this, got really tired of talking about me and my book. But Cosmopolitan Magazine for years would call me every time they did a story in which they needed someone to talk about, you know, the science of gender, this. And I would say to them, "Why don't you talk to a real scientist, right?" And they'd go, "Well, real scientists won't call us back. They don't want to be in Cosmopolitan Magazine." And so I would talk to them. I'm a journalist, right? So then I'd feel sorry for them, and I'd go, "Well, you know, okay, let me see what I can tell you," right? But you get that too, which is, for someone like me, yeah, I'm fine. It doesn't bother me to sound like an idiot in Cosmopolitan Magazine, right? That doesn't bother me at all. But it does scientists, and so they won't get themselves out there, right? They just won't. It's not their culture. They're not sitting around going, "Oh, I wonder if I can be in a magazine that preaches sexual positions to young women." They just don't want to do it, whereas I don't care.
Right.
So.
Yeah, that's an interesting distinction over there.
Yeah.
Very cool. So now I want to move on to the next subject, which is your faculty career at the UW-Madison Journalism School.
Mm-hmm.
So you joined the faculty in 1997.
That's right.
Could you talk about what made you decide to come back to UW-Madison
sure.
To teach?
Well, I am, you know, very attached to UW-Madison. But when I first came out, I really wasn't sure I wanted the job. I thought, well, this will be an interesting experiment. I can go out in the way job interviews can make you think about who you want to be. And I went out and I realized that for who I wanted to be a book writer. I wanted to experiment with different kinds of writing. It was clear that the position that they were offering me would be hugely supportive of that. And so when they did offer me the job, I took it. I wasn't really thinking about teaching so much at that time. I was thinking, I'll be a writer and oh yeah, I'll teach. And so the first semester I was here, I had no idea what I was doing, right? I had taught one class at Fresno State while I was a reporter at Fresno State. That was it. And I was teaching, we used to have a class called Public Affairs Reporting, and I changed the name of that to In-Depth Reporting. And I was teaching, the grad class in specialized reporting, and which we now call long-form journalism. We'll change the names of all this stuff. And I would sit, I'd be talking, and people would be taking notes, and I'd be, oh my God, they're writing down what I said. I was like, and I have no idea what I'm doing. So it was scary to me at first, but I think... the thing that has always been important to me in the teaching, one, I'm a mother hen, right, which you probably heard me talking about my kids. I tend to, like, by nature be a mother hen. So I, you know, always thought of these students as my kids, and I always wanted them to get better. And one of the things I realized early on was that I was the only working journalist in the department, right? That's not necessarily a good thing because you end up being the outlier, right? But... that I could bring this very professional perspective to the way I taught, and that I was never, and never have, in fact, been in a position of saying, well, you know, 20 years ago when I was in the business, I'll always teach because I'm in the business today, right? So if I had quit doing that, I would have come here as a newspaper reporter. Yeah, I don't know what I wouldn't have the experience blogging, right? So I've really matched my professional writing with the way I teach, and that has allowed me to design new courses for the program and teach them, I think, in some innovative ways that I've liked. For a couple of semesters, I had done an ebook for the Atavist called Angel Killer. When did that come out? A couple of years ago. It's a true crime story of a really icky serial killer who stalks and eats small children. He's a really famous American serial killer, but I kept my connection with the Atavist, and so they do have an educational format where you can have your students learn to publish ebooks. You have to pay. So I used some of the money from my endowed chair. I got that a few years after I came here. Actually, I'm not exactly sure when. Sometime in the early 20s, 21st century. Mm-hmm. And so I used some money from that. And so I taught ebook classes. And I actually Skyped in the Atavist people from New York to help do the training for my students. And they all published ebooks as their final projects, right? I wouldn't have known about this or how to do it or who to talk to if I wasn't a working writer. So it's really shaped the way I teach. And I think it shaped the way I teach in positive ways. I do.
Okay, cool. So you mentioned that as the only working journalism in the program, that you were able to bring in professional mm-hmm. perspective to the program to design some new courses. Could you talk about some courses you designed other than the you talk about the ebook class,
the e-book class.
Some other classes?
Right. Well, I changed the public affairs reporting to in-depth reporting, and that was the start of our investigative reporting program. And now I teach investigative reporting, which had never been taught at the school before, and I teach that in collaboration with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. This semester, we've been running a semester-long project on groundwater contamination in Wisconsin. And I'd been an investigative reporter, right, at a lot of newspapers, so I added that. I think they're not sure who's going to teach it when I leave, because There isn't anyone else who has investigative reporting background on the faculty, so we'll see what happens. And then because I did narrative nonfiction so much, I created a class called Creative Nonfiction. And that's a class in which you learn structure, voice, style, attitude. You learn, journalism students get, journalism is very architectural. And so the standard architecture of a news story is an inverted pyramid style where the important stuff is at the top and the trivia is at the bottom. And but narrative writing uses all other kinds of structures and styles. So I teach that class, and we do all kinds of goofy things that they have to write about. Eat strange food, play games, go to the art museum and write in a color, right? I mean, and that class was the one class that I designed that everyone loved to teach besides me, right? You didn't have to be a journalist to love to teach, you know, creative ways to write. And so Jim Boffman, who's the history of journalism professor, teaches it. And Joellen Fair, who, well, she's leaving the Department for Global Studies, but she does like our international journalism research person. She teaches it. People just thought it was fun to teach. And it's been the class where that class always waitlists, right? Students think it's going to be easy and don't realize how hard it's going to be, right? But everyone wants to learn how to do creative writing. So that class, I taught the science writing class, was already there, and I continued to teach that. And so it's really been investigative, creative nonfiction, long form journalism, magazine writing I added on, and then I experimented with magazine writing and ebooks. And then the other class, I taught this for 2 years, was there's an alum of, is he alum? Anyway, there's an alum of the university, Peter Greenberg. He's the travel editor for CBS. And for 2 years, I taught a travel writing class with Peter. That was, like, challenging. Mm-hmm. I'm not a travel writer, and Peter is very conscious of his, you know, status. And he was super tough on the kids because he has only worked at a very wealthy, high-end level for years, and he just could not relate to, you know, young kids who had never sold a story in their life, right? And even when they would say, well, I'm going to pitch a story to Madison Magazine, he'd go, oh, no, that's aiming too low. Just, but it was a really fun class. They learned a lot. I learned a lot. And again, now that I'm leaving, there's no one to teach that. And this is really one of the sad things, is that there isn't anyone there who's going to teach. I think they'll still teach creative nonfiction. Uh-huh. I don't know what's going to happen to science writing. Sharon retired. I'm retiring. They don't have anyone else in the department to teach that. There's definitely not going to be anyone teaching an ebook class. I think they'll keep the investigative reporting class, you know, because the Center for Investigative Reporting is in the journalism school. But, and I don't mean to overstate my incredible value and worth. Some of this is budget related, right? They're not going to be able to replace me for a while. There's not a lot of money for adjuncts. But I worry. It's one of the things that's made me feel really bad about leaving at this moment, right? So, because I love the things I've done, and I hate the idea that they'll be lost. But, and maybe they won't be, right? But I don't know.
Yeah. Well, hopefully in a couple of years, the journalism school will be able to get back to the feet and then start to do some more recruiting.
I think that's right. We have a wonderful,
after we recover.
We will recover. And the journalism school has an absolutely wonderful head. He's great. And he's very committed to, you know, building back up the journalism. So, you know, I think I need to not, like I said, I tend to mother hen stuff. I don't think I need to be a mother hen for the journalism school. It'll be fine, but I hope they'll be able to bring back some of the stuff I've done.
Yeah, absolutely. at the as a faculty in the journalism school, you're also a faculty affiliate of the Science and Technology Studies program.
I am.
Is that right?
That's mostly just my name is on as an affiliate, right? I've done some talks over there. You know, I vote when they are voting for things, but that's been, and that's probably on me, right? That's mm-hmm. been a pretty minimal association.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, besides that association, you were also involved in other professional affiliations,
right.
Such as that you were the former president of the National Association of Science Writers.
That's right. And I'm the vice president today of the Council for the Advancement of Science Writing, which is the group that, the difference is that NASW is a membership group and CASW is a nonprofit, but we do a joint meeting and we work together in training science journalists, and training science writers is really important to me. So the other thing I've been involved with, for 4 years I was the North American board member for the World Federation of Science Journalists, and I was the program chair of the World Conference of Science Journalists in Doha, Qatar in 2011. That was quite the challenge. And I was on the program committee of the next meeting, which was in Helsinki, Finland, and I'm on the program committee of this year's meeting, which is in Seoul, South Korea. So I'm going to South Korea this June.
This June?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's a lot of, that's like crazy timing, because you were going to MIT, start teaching at MIT in July.
And everything's crazy timing. So so I'm not going to teach at MIT. I'm going to run a program.
Right.
Right. But yeah. So I said to MIT, and MIT has been really great about this, but I said to them, can I have an extra week? Right. So my official start there is July the 1st, but I am not showing up in the office till July the 6th. That would be great.
Okay.
So, but yeah, it's crazy timing.
Right.
So.
And at MIT, you are going to be directing the Night Science Journalism Program.
Right.
I think that's the name.
And that's a center that runs a fellowship and journalism training kind of programs. It has a endowment from the Knight Science, from the John and James S. Knight Foundation gave them an endowment, and so the center's budget is entirely off its own endowment. And it's housed at MIT, but it runs as a independent program at MIT.
Okay.
It's which is kind of fun.
Yeah. I wonder if you could talk about the hiring process from the MIT.
Yeah, so what happened there was the current director retired, and they advertised for this, they advertised this job, and I didn't apply. I actually had this long talk with a friend of mine. I have an old friend who works at the Wall Street Journal. I've known him since I was at the Fresno Bee, and he was at the Pittsburgh paper, so we've known each other a long time. But so I had breakfast with him when I was doing some stuff in New York, and he goes, you should apply for this job. And I said, this is a sucky time of my life to go work. I was thinking, this is just, why would I want to move now? And he said, Deborah, he said, you're such a girl. He says, everyone knows that good opportunities don't come at convenient times. He said, it was just real. That's a female reaction, that this is not convenient. Go for the good opportunity. That's what I need, another lecture on how to be a better woman. And so, from a man. But I didn't apply. I thought about it, and then I thought, I'm not going to do it, right? And then one of the guys who was on the search committee contacted me, and he said, we're looking to expand the pool of applicants beyond the people who apply, and we would really like you to apply. And I thought, and I think if he hadn't done that, I would have been fine, right? But I thought, well, okay, right? I still had my friend Lee Holtz's words in the back of my head, right? And I thought, maybe this would be one more opportunity for me to think about who I want to be when I grow up. And this would be, because I love science journalism and reporting so much, I could really, this would be a program where I could really make a difference if I think it through right. So I said to my friend who was on the search committee, I said, well, you've closed the application process. He said, that doesn't matter, right? It's like, and that's always true, right? He said, just go ahead and apply. We're going to leave the, you had to apply online. He said, we're going to leave that open. And so I did. And so I applied. They called me up and they said, do you want to come out for an interview? And I thought, okay, I'll go out for an interview. And I went out. They offered me the job. I came back. And I went to my department chair, who I really love and who's a great guy. It's brand new. I said, listen, I'm thinking, I've been talking to MIT. I just want to let you know I'm having this conversation. He said, okay. And I never heard from him again. And he later said to me, he goes, you know, he was brand new in the job and he didn't know what to do. And I had been offered a job at Kansas the previous year. And they had made a counter and I'd stayed, right? And he didn't know, like, he was like, you're not supposed to, like, you know, do counters for another 3 years. And so he was completely paralyzed. And I was off going, wow, they really don't want to keep me here. And so I took the job, right? And then, yeah, it was a big wow. And I'm not dinging him. I really like him. I think if like he had been a little more experienced and come back to me, I might not have taken the job, right? That, like I said, I'm very attached to Wisconsin. But at that moment, I'm just like, okay, right? I'm going to go do this other thing. And then I negotiated for a one-year stay. I took the job a year ago. And so that I could see my son through this transition into UW, that was super important to me. That was the big thing I knew. I asked for more money too, but mostly I said, I want to stay at Wisconsin another year. And that's made it really hard, right? Because I've had a whole year to regret my decision. In some ways, you know, it's been like I'm here, my job is better, I like my department chair, what was I thinking? But on the other hand, wow, this is an amazing adventure and I'm going to do all this great stuff and MIT's a fabulous job. And one of my friends said to me, you wanted to hit one more, it's a sports analogy, unfortunately. She goes, you wanted to hit one more long ball. And I said, yeah, that's right. I've worked really hard and I'm good at what I do. And for someone like me who came up on the public school side, right, straight public university girl to go to an Ivy and have this and run this very prestigious program, I'm like, wow, I should do this. Go out, make a difference. And I know I can. I know I can be at that program. And from having this year, so the plus side of it is I've had a year, MIT hired me as a visiting scholar because I was doing so much work, to understand the program and get smart about it. And so I know I can walk in after this year with a really great sense of what I want to do and with the sky's the limit kind of sense because there's a lot of money, right? And that'll be fun.
Yeah.
It's fun to have a lot of money, right?
Yeah.
I'm going to spend it.
Okay. Yeah, I think in another interview that you gave or another a piece of article that I read somewhere that you said that you were hoping to make some changes that will build upon the program's success at MIT.
So it's one, that program is about 40 years old, maybe a little older. I'm the first female director, as they keep saying in their press releases. But it's really run on, it started as a mid-career fellowship program. You take, mostly staff writers would take a break after years of success and rejuvenate themselves. And the way the fellowship program works, it pays, if you get it, you get $70,000 and you can go to MIT and Harvard for free for a year. So it's a good program, right? Lots of, and we had 150 applicants for the 10 spots this year, which was pretty amazing. and also very time consuming.
Right, absolutely.
So it was really hard to narrow it down. In my profession, it's a well-known and highly respected program. Outside of the geeky profession of science writing, no one's ever heard of it. And I feel like, this is how I feel. This is a program with a solid endowment. It has a reasonable budget. It has money. It's at a real great university. It ought to be part of a national and international conversation about how we communicate science better. I mean, people ought to know it, and it ought to be making a difference, and it ought to be an international resource. If you go to the website now, it's just all about who we are and our field trips. But if I'm a science writer working in Iran or Argentina, there's nothing there to help me, right? I'm going to redesign the website. I'm going to make it a resource. I'm going to publish a free. This is one of the things I want to do for my out of estate. Publish a free science library. I'm going to have the fellows and other people write for that. I've already contracted for my first ebook on climate change. Right, so anyone all over the world can get these and download them for free. I'm going to do some experimenting, what works, what doesn't work. I'm already in discussions with, I have a friend who works for NOVA. He and I are just going to do a collaboration that's going to be more, can we run analytics on why a science story succeeds or doesn't succeed? And I'm going to do experiments. And I'm going to partner. And in fact, I have a phone call scheduled this Friday with the editor of a magazine called Science News, which is a total science insider magazine, on things that we could do as partnerships, right? And so I'm going to make this something that is known in like the way I communicate science. I want it to be a resource for people who are interested in science or curious about science or afraid of science. I want it to be a great training resource for journalists, and I want it to make a difference, right? Mm-hmm. And I believe that I can do this. This is my son. Do you mind if we...
No, go ahead.
Hey, buddy. Oh, gee. Well, then call Dean right away and reschedule. And I know that's a big pain, bud. Did you make it? Oh, Lucas, always take the earliest appointment. Okay, here's what I would do. Okay, here's what I would do. Lucas, let me say this. Here's what I would do. Take the earliest dermatology appointment, but your regular physician, like Dr. Cooley, can give you prescription dermatology stuff. Go back to her and say, I can't get this appointment to June. I really need this sooner. When's the soonest I can come in? She has the kind of a schedule that they can get you in super fast. Okay, that's what I would do. I've gotten, what's that, baby? Okay, but does what I say make sense? Doesn't matter. You can see, she's your doctor, you can see her as many times as you want. And that's what I would do. I'd do keep the dermatology one, but just say to her, I need to start on something for this now. She can prescribe that stuff. She's a general service practitioner. Okay, my buddy. And I'll see you in just a little bit, okay, sweetie? Okay. I love you, honey. Bye-bye. Look how bossy I am with my kids. Do this. Anyway.
So you accepted the job offer a year ago.
Yeah, a year ago in July. So okay. Yeah.
And sounds like you are going to there's a lot of exciting opportunities that you want to work on with your visions for the program.
That's exactly right. And so the other thing I've done this year is I've been talking to the John S. and James S. Knight Foundation about the things that I want to do. And I've got to, in fact, this month I have got to send them a memo on all of my brilliant plans. I'm going to try to work on that over the next week. And they're going to update the agreement. And they said, if you know, they'll give me a little more money to play with. I mean, they have a $2 billion foundation, so they're like, you know, so we'll give you some, you know, a couple hundred thousand as a vote of confidence. I'm like, okay, that will be good. Yeah, so that's going to be fun.
Okay, yeah. Cool. So I wonder, after you decided to go to MIT, to direct the program, I wonder, was your family very supportive of the decision?
No.
No?
Yes and no. I mean, my husband said to me, he said, at the time I took the job, he said, you need to make a change because you were so frustrated. And I was frustrated. And this is just you. You always want to do the one more great thing. And he said, I won't love it, but let's do it. It'll be better for the family. But he didn't say, oh, wow, I can't wait to move to Boston. Everyone else was kind of like, really, Mom? I think everyone, including me, up until this, thought I was going to gradually retire at Wisconsin. And so this is like blew everything up for this change. Everyone's gotten used to it. And so... my kids are now kind of excited about it, right? At first they were like, but I won't tell you that they're all like, wow, this is so great, right? We are moving to Boston. But they're supportive enough. And my younger son, my older guy's in Chicago. He's like, whatever. Uh-huh. And my younger guy said to me, maybe I'll go to grad school in Boston. So my husband, who moved to Wisconsin for me, is now like, and here we are, moving for you again, right? And that, we've had to work on that. And I think that's normal, too. So, you know, it's like, if you are the person in the family who are sort of shifting everyone around for your career, speaking of balancing acts, right? Yeah. You can't expect, I want everyone to be honest, you can't expect them to all go, oh wow, we're happy to just give up our home that we've lived in for almost 20 years and everything. So again, it's all compromise, right? Like, I would like to move into some urban apartment and do the real city life. I think that'd be so fun. Well, and my husband wants a dog in a yard. So she rolls her eyes. We're gonna have a dog in a yard.
Yeah,
that's the compromise. But the other thing is, he's not going to move when I move. He's going to stay for a while, as while my younger son goes off to the U, and make sure that's a good transition. And I'm going to, as I'm always saying to people, I'm going to camp in Boston, right? I have a friend who has an apartment in Harvard Square that she doesn't use in the summer, and so I'm going to stay in Chris's empty apartment for a while. And I'm going to figure out some other place to camp, and then we'll see how it goes, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And we have no idea how we're going to make this work at this point. So it's like one giant adventure, which I'm coming to realize I love. I love the fact that I can have one more adventure, right?
Yeah, it's exciting. It's always exciting to have an adventure.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Instead of saying, well, you know, I can see in my future, you know, I'll be here another 5 years and then we'll get an RV. That was never going to be me. I realized that. I was always going to want to do really interesting things. So this is going to be more interesting than I'd hoped in some ways.
Right.
It's going to be interesting.
Yeah. You choose to live an interesting life rather than to live do something more predictable.
That's exactly right. And there's a plus and a minus to that. I mean, when I quit my job in Sacramento, my editor there, who didn't want me to go, he said, why are you doing this? You have a great job here. I said, because it's easy. I had been a newspaper science writer for 15 years. I knew how to do it. There wasn't any challenge to it. And he said, well, some people like that. You know, you get to the point where it's easy. You're not stressed out over your job, right? You're just coasting along. But, and so this is maybe, this is a plus and a minus, but I'm not very good at coasting, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is your husband working in at the UW as well, or?
No, he's a freelance writer also.
Oh, okay.
So he, after we moved here, he worked for a number of different companies as a writer and an editor, and he wrote popular history stuff. He wrote two editions of World History for Dummies, and he wrote two other books, and he wrote a history of 20th century biology, and he so we're like, as my kids always point out, like the nerd family, right? But we both really love history, and so he can move anywhere he wants, right?
That's great.
Yeah, I'm not upsetting his career plans at all.
Right.
And I think when I talk to him at this point, he's sort of winding that down. He really wants to try writing novels, and I'm like, go for it, right? You know, and we're lucky that way. And I've said that to him so many times. I mean, we're lucky. I make enough money that he can be a novelist if he wants to be, right?
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone gets that,
right? Yeah.
So it's a wonderful opportunity.
Yeah, it's always nice to have different opportunities that you can try out in your life.
That's right. And the trick is, you know, to know when you should take them and then to make the best of them, right?
That's absolutely
right.
I think that was really my last question.
That was a pretty good ending too.
Yeah, so before we just to wrap up, I wonder if there is anything else that I didn't cover but you would like to share with us.
No, actually, you've been great. I mean, I've talked about everything I think that has mattered to me, right? You know, I'm still doing the balancing act, as you can tell, not perfectly. So I don't think anyone's going to come to me as a model of how to perfectly balance your life. Sometimes after I won the Pulitzer, I thought, well, be careful what you wish for, right? But I love the idea, I'm 60, that I can, at this stage of my life, go do something else really exciting. Right, and so I'm looking forward to what comes next.
Great. That's a great ending for this oral interview.
Good.
Oral history interview. I think I'm just going to stop the recorder. That's all right.